For decades, milk has been fueling women marathon runners as the OG performance drink. And in the new docuseries, Running Sucks, brought to you by Team Milk, Abby Ayers takes us on a journey of self-discovery as she meets several groups of empowered women runners to find out what drives them, what fuels them, and what pushes them to go the distance. And in the process, she learns that she, too, can be a distance runner. You can watch the series at runningsucktheseries.com and register for the inaugural Every Woman's Marathon at everywomansmarathon.com.
I think we can all agree the current political moment is fraught. But how does it compare to the other fraught political moments in history?
It felt for a time in part of that decade like everything was falling apart. Young people against old people, anti-war violence, peace movement.
I'm former U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara. And this week, presidential historian Doris Kearns Goodwin joins me on my podcast, Stay Tuned with Preet. We talk about difficult times in America's history and how its people overcame them. The episode is out now. Search and follow Stay Tuned with Preet wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the Longform Podcast. I'm Max Linsky, and I'm here, as usual, with Evan Ratliff and Aaron Lammer. Hey, dudes.
Hey, Max.
Hello. This week, we have Aaron, who interviewed the least sarcastic man in journalism, Corey Sika.
Yes, I did. This is a bit of a first for the show in that Corey is an editor and one of the founders of The All. So rather than talking to a writer about their work, we're zooming out and talking about a publication, website, magazine, whatever we call these things nowadays. But it was a really interesting discussion. Corey told me he was bored 10 minutes in, but that doesn't mean his answers weren't interesting.
He's the first editor we've had on the show and the first person to completely dodge softball questions.
He takes a circumnavigable route around questions, but he's an interesting dude and has seen a lot of things go up and down in New York. And has some interesting stories to tell, and a book coming out. I'm not sure if it's out yet, but it'll be out soon, so check that out. And check out our sponsor, Tiny Letter.
TinyLetter.com. What is Tiny Letter, Aaron?
It's a massively simple yet profoundly powerful way to send an email newsletter.
Massively simple. TinyLetter.com.
Sika.
It's not true. Yes, that is my name.
Coming fresh off of another interview, back-to-back, and I'm a bit sick, so we're going to keep it peppy. Corey, most people probably know as the founder of The All, previously at Gawker.
Can I add co in the founder?
Co-founder of The All. A founding editor of Gawker, or a second generation?
I was a second tier.
Second tier. editor at Gawker before The All. So when did you show up in New York City?
I came here on a Greyhound bus circa 1993. I'm off by a year somewhere in there, but 20 years ago.
And what were your dreams when you arrived?
I had no dreams.
No dreams.
No, no.
Crushed dreams.
No, I wasn't much of a planner. No, I don't really. Yeah, I don't know why I came.
Really?
It's a nice town.
What did you do when you arrived?
I refused to let all the men in the Greyhound bus station take my bags, as they were trying to do. I guess I was... I had a job at... I had a little room in the East Village, which was $300 a month. And I interviewed people for research studies for UCLA at Kings County Hospital. So I would go out to Kings County Hospital and be locked in a room with these poor kids who had to be grilled by me, just like you're doing to me today, for 3 hours.
So this experience is like being in a clinical study for you.
Yes. It was a terrible thing. And I actually had to quit because I started cheating at the end with the study, because it was 3 hours and these kids were 17. They're all HIV positive. And so it was 3 hours about their sex and drug use. So I literally was this is not worth your time. The small amount of money we're paying you is not worth it. So I'd literally be just skip sections.
Just filling in false medical data.
I think so.
What was sort of the jump for you that got you into blogging, for a better word, lack of a better word, or writing online?
I had a good friend who was still in California, where I had left, and I was in New York, and we concocted a two-person blog to keep in touch. As
really?
A way to write public letters.
What, like, what is the state of the blog at this point? What CMS are we talking about?
That here? Was, they had just rolled out Blogger. we used that for a while. Wow, we hacked together most of it, but that was the specs back in CMS was Blogger, I think. Yeah.
Were other people reading it, or was it a two-way street?
Well, what happened was, so we sort of found a community of people. We started reading other people. I mean, there were not that many people blogging, so, but we found all the gay people first, which was interesting, and there were like 20, 25 of them. And then we realized we'd marginalized ourselves into a group of people. So we were like, we're going to actively like seek out other people. And so then there was a whole underground community, you know, underground. Every community was above ground to itself, but we were underground, everybody else
right.
too. So, but then we found this whole community of, you know, African-American bloggers, and then like a bunch of straight people and different people from Canadians.
How did you find, I mean, how were you finding these communities?
You would just have to follow links on people's blogs, because everyone had link.
Like a blog rolls.
Yeah, I guess that's the word they started using. And then the problem was, and so then you would just follow and follow, and you'd be like, oh, look at these people. These are so cool. And like, that's how I met people on the, you know, all over the world. And then the war bloggers started, which no one talks about anymore. But
war
after 9/11, Irony died first. And then second of all.
Wait a minute. I thought Irony died this weekend.
Oh, Irony died again and again. It's sad. It's sad about Irony.
More on that later.
No, not at all. then these people started all these war blogs. These people had to find a way to promote their new
pro-war blogs,
ways to agitate for invading Iraq, basically. I'm sure they were all on the government payroll. Jeff Jarvis was one of them.
Really?
I'm not saying he was on the government payroll. Please don't make that leap.
I think we've got a poll quote, Lauren.
But Jeff Jarvis was, you know, his blog was very different than it is now. And I mean, you know, it was an interesting time. It was, we all dealt with it in our own ways.
What were you writing about on your own blog?
Oh, I mean, you know, a lot of it was very diaristic early on.
Well, it's interesting to me because
it's just like thought catalog.
I know a lot of people who were early bloggers in New York now, but haven't actually read any of the blogs that made them famous bloggers at the time.
Did you put, I hope, I didn't even hear air quotes on famous to any of these people.
You're famous. You're a famous blogger.
No, not I. I was talking about the other ones. The
people like Anil Dash,
right.
who was an early blog maker.
We used to make fun of them. It was fun.
Yeah.
Because like there were only like 100, well, there were a couple thousand people, right? But then so we, like, throwing stones back then was, you know, it was like throwing stones inside a small room.
And did you see, like, I'm sort of interested at what point, your output and what was going on around you sort of evolved from that sort of click, like 100 people. When did you start seeing a mass external audience coming in?
It was like 2001, 2002. And again, I blame 9/11. not really. but you know, Gawker started in 2002.
Yeah.
And that was sort of a big deal, because there had been professional blogs before that was a very different kind of professional blog.
Well, I remember, like, I was a big AOL kid.
Mm, sure. Yeah, actually, me too, weirdly.
I was running up the bills, the dial-up bills on AOL. And AOL had things that had some of the qualities of paid blogging inside it, but they were only open, I think, to the AOL portal.
Yes, they were not actually on the internet.
Yeah. I mean, this is something that few people, I think, who are a bit younger realizes that the internet actually wasn't the internet when I was a teenager. The internet was a series of portals that there was one you could get the World Wide Web inside of AOL, but it was kind of like buried in there.
Yeah,
chat rooms were really much more prevalent.
Amazing too. I wonder what happened to those people I used to chat with. Were they you? Who were those people?
It'd probably be.
It's probably just us.
Just us.
So weird.
So Gawker started, I think, 2002 or 2003. I think Gawker's an interesting...
Dude, just celebrated its 10-year anniversary.
10-year anniversary.
Which is hard to believe.
That's very hard to believe. What brought you to Gawker in the first place?
To reading it?
No, to writing for it.
Well, oh, first to writing for it. Well, reading it was there. There wasn't, you know, that much on the internet. And also Elizabeth was, you know, brilliant and funny and tart and weird. And but also she was going to leave and I just was there.
Did you?
You know, Nick Denton used to pay me. The first time they paid me, he went to an ATM and gave me some cash.
Like how much cash was that?
Well, the salary then was $24,000 a year.
That's still the starting salary in publishing. So
in publishing, yes, but then you're crazy if you take.
I was working in publishing. I think probably making about $24,000 a year when I first started reading Gawker, and I had no idea that there was a media world in New York. I didn't even know understand what the topic.
Do you love Gawker. Books?
Yeah, no, I was real into Hemingway. At the Ooh. Time, you know, like I was Why? Reading the class, I was reading like classic American literature. Everything since then has been downhill. So what was that like stepping into that role?
What did you think you were getting into? I have no idea what I was doing. It was crazy. I mean, thank God I remember nothing. Yeah, it was fascinating. I mean, look, it was great. It was like a good time. It was funny.
So you started The Awl 3.5 years ago, and that's really that's your work that I'm the most familiar with. I've been an Awl reader since the beginning. I've wasted many hours reading it.
We thank you.
Where did that start for you? What was day one of The Awl for you?
Like most people, we had thought, well, you know, we had looked at what to do with our lives at that juncture. As you'll recall, it was an interesting time in the world, sort of dark times. I had, written to an editor at Lucky Magazine asking for work writing captions and hadn't gotten a response.
Lucky Magazine, as I recall, is a shopping magazine?
Yes, it was. Like, literally, I was like, anyone who will give me $5 at this point, I will happily suck that dick. You know, and I would love to write captions. You know, the captions are an art form.
Absolutely.
The best job I ever had was writing listings. Like, you had to get them so tight and so small and so vivid that it was a writing workshop every week. It was great.
Do you think Twitter is going to have that effect on people? People are going to learn apparently, to, like, write shorter?
Apparently not. I mean, it's not helping.
Doesn't seem that way to me.
It's not doing what I hoped it would do.
You had that belief that Twitter would... tighten up those adjectives.
Twitter's a great thing. Like, if you sit around and you're like, oh, I'm trying to say this thing, I'm trying to make this joke, or I'm trying to express this idea, then you're like, you have to swap words, you have to mess with it. It's actually great.
I think it's improved my writing.
Yeah. Writing, having to write short is awesome for you. I love those jobs.
Like, we rewrite the decks for stories for long form because they have to fit in a certain thing in our app. And I love it. It's pure zen. Trying to turn like a four sentence Vanity Fair deck into like a two sentence deck.
Cozy. Feels good. I love a character limit. I wish we had a product now with a character limit. I'd be thrilled.
Well, I mean, this is something that I'm sort of interesting. I want to get back to the start of The Awl, but in talking to you about The Awl as a, I'm putting the air quotes on, product, you seem more aware than other writers and editors that I've talked to of how people perceive that product, how they digest it. When we were coming in here, you were like, yeah, the podcast should be shorter. That's what people want. You've actually thought of what we call in the technology field, the user experience of reading a blog and reading writing on the internet. I'm interested in how you conceived of The Awl when you were saying, hey, I'm going to, you know, go and take some money and start a blog, or take no money and start a blog.
I mean, right. So we had been talking, the group of us, about what to do. And actually we had at one point we even had a business proposal, which was not very good. And actually we had talked to someone about giving us money early on, which thankfully fell apart. And then we realized that we could continue scheming and never do anything, or we could just do it. So we actually just launched.
What drives you? What do you see The Awl as at its best?
I don't have an answer to that. I mean, there's weeks at work when you feel bad and weeks at work when you feel good. And I feel good when I'm like, oh, wow, like a couple people wrote some really awesome things, or like we had like actually fun meetings in the office. And I usually feel better when I don't feel frustrated writing. Like when I've gotten to write a couple things and they're not totally terrible or not totally rushed. And you know, and that's like good enough. And like, it's weird how what there's no, yeah, there's no rhyme or reason to really feeling good or bad about work like this.
You're the first writer editor we've had on the podcast.
Oh,
you're
interesting.
Pulling Pete Rose duty.
Yeah, that's me.
Not the gambling part. You know, I think a lot of people think that the internet just sort of happens and that magazines, you know, people pitch stories in big offices and that there's a different process. How do you make the content that goes on the all?
The best way to make content is to have someone do it for you. So we actually outsourced it to China. No,
China's too expensive now for blogging.
We outsourced it to Utah, the captive nearshoring audience. It's all produced by Mormons, which is why we endorsed Romney this year, like the New York Observer. The
New York Observer really endorsed Romney?
Yes, the New York Observer really endorsed Romney.
Where's the stake in that? You could just do no endorsement. Then you don't have to have been the people who endorsed Romney.
Right, who endorsed an obvious loser.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, but, at that point, you can just be silent.
I don't know. When Donald Trump is your father-in-law, I think a lot of wacky dinner table conversations happen.
Yeah. You can believe it.
Yeah. How awkward would that be? Hi, Donald. My point being, you hire someone to do that for you very well. And the answer to that question is Carrie Fry, who is our managing editor, mm-hmm. who is a managing editor in the sense that she manages, but is also really a features editor.
Yeah.
And that's her strength and wheelhouse. And honestly, a lot of times I can ignore her duties because she's so strong. And
were you Carrie Fry before Carrie Fry was Carrie Fry?
Yeah, we traded off some duties, but yeah.
You and Alex Bach. I guess I'm interested in, most people are not even doing features at the level. You know, most web-only publications are doing focusing largely on short-form content. Was doing these features a ambition from the beginning with all?
Probably yeah. That was something we thought we'd do, but we didn't know how we'd get there or how that would happen. It happened really early, really organically.
Okay.
People didn't have anywhere to put that stuff. People didn't have anywhere to write for. I mean, that sounds crazy to say, but they...
Well, it's not crazy to say. I mean, one thing I've learned in dealing with writers on the stuff a lot is that a lot of pieces you see on the web are actually killed by mm-hmm. other magazines, or they were originally pitches. You know, this was mm-hmm. a GQ pitch that is now here. It ended up there. What's the source of a lot of these all features? Are people coming in with an idea, coming in with a finished story?
It's all across the map. There's definitely times when people pitch this stuff and I'm like, please take this to a fancy magazine.
Really?
Like, I'm like, oh yeah. I'm like, please call X person at GQ and please go somewhere bigger.
And why are you not batting for the home team there?
Because I would like to see them paid at a magazine word rate for those things. I mean, I would like to see everyone paid at a magazine word rate constantly.
Yeah. Right.
Including for, you know, their tweets. No.
What? That brings up another interesting question. How do you view paying writers on the web?
It's an interesting question because
a lot of people don't know.
What we do is we generally have set aside a percentage of our income uh-huh. and divided that up, in a month. So, that varies though. We try and pay attention to things that take lots of labor and whatnot.
I'm assuming that the all makes more money now than it did in its first year. Does that mean you're able to pay out more money?
We did not pay ourselves for the first 2 years. Yes. So yes.
so the money goes first to the editorial team and then is split among writers on some sort of a basis.
Yeah. Something like that. Roughly.
Yeah,
that's
okay.
Fair. One thing we do is with other websites is that we don't hire in the traditional system. We only go into business with people to start websites. Mm-hmm. So those people are all owner operators.
So the websites that Corey's talking about are Hairpin,
yeah.
which is a woman's website. Is that
it
fair
is
to
a
say?
People's website.
It's a people's website
that is
with a focus on
something.
Women.
I don't know, something like that.
And Splitsider, which is a
sorry, ladies.
People who like comedy website.
Which is devoted to comedy entirely.
And Billfold, which is dedicated to personal finance.
Yeah, it's about how we live with money.
So those are all projects that people have brought to you as a partnership.
Someone's come to someone and yeah.
And what is the incentive for you to broaden, into that stuff?
It's a good question. I have many questions now about whether all of our websites should be one website.
Yes. Well, I know that the content is sort of syndicated amongst the,
yeah, we try and share when appropriate. But it's also sort of fun to have kind of small-ish publications that get to do their own thing.
And what do you provide them with in those situations?
A shoulder to cry on, and the knowledge that either it gets better or it gets worse.
Other than your personal audits, of course.
Personal audits. I don't like that thing you wrote earlier today. Can you imagine if someone's looking over your shoulder? We're not. That's the nice thing about being in business with them is that we don't actually. We just leave them alone.
You don't even know where they are.
I have no idea where they are. They could be anywhere. We definitely provide advertising services. We provide accounting and blah, 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 and payrolls. And
that broadens
riveting discussion.
It broadens the base to which you can sell the advertising.
The thing is that people come to me pretty much every week, right? Yep. Come to me and Alex and the rest of the people there, and they're like, I'm starting this website about Canadian candy makers.
Yes.
And pretty much that's all they are. Everyone likes that. And they're like, what's the secret? I'm like, the secret is when we launched, there were three of us. Two of us were doing editorial, and one of us was doing business. And guess what? We had a new product, and he had nothing to do all day. So he had to make himself a job that was about revenue. And so I meet all these people, and I'm like, so who is this dedicated person at your company? And they're like, well, we're both editorial people,
bloggers.
I'm like, well, you're a host. That's it. Yeah. You're done. That's it. No more. Don't bother.
What is it that the money man provides that makes what you're doing viable?
The nice thing about our company is because we started with nothing, as nothing, with literally less than nothing, which is really sad and pitiful, and don't do that.
How are you eating during this period?
I had some savings, which I spent, and then I got evicted. And then stuff happened.
We keep skipping all the best parts of the story.
Then I had my own IRS case manager, just like Wesley Snipes. This is bad stuff to talk about. He had to invent, a business, right? Mm-hmm. Or learn a business. So you're making something. This happens with any two or more people. If one person is making something and someone is attached to be the revenue person, they will find a way to. Or not, possibly, but they will try to find a way to make that thing self-sustaining.
Because that's their job.
Because that's their job. And so they will find out. You know what? And I met with a bunch of people who were sort of at the same stage as me. And it was interesting that all of our models were very different. Like one person was like, I will make most of my money at this website through consulting, actually.
Mm-hmm.
She would see brands. She would talk to advertisers. She would do in-house training. And that was going to be her main revenue model, and already was, which is something that would never, A, occur to us, or B, be useful to us. It wouldn't happen.
And the All makes its money primarily through advertising.
Primarily through advertising. So as we grow up, we're looking at ways to not rely entirely on advertising.
And it seems like the advertising itself has evolved over time from mm-hmm. sort of simple banner ads to now more sort of site sponsored takeovers, sponsored posts. Has that crashed into the editorial vision at all for you?
We definitely have not done stuff for sure. We definitely have turned away stuff that's either visually or whatever, just not right. A lot of the times digital budgets are sort of the bottom of the barrel. They've already done their out-of-door advertising. They've already done their TV stuff. And then they're like, oh, we have this bucket for digital. Okay, here, let's shovel some crap on the internet. And they don't have a well-thought-out product. And so we are saying to people like, oh, no, we can help you. Like, we can make this better for you. Like, let's not put advertising online that's going to go places that just completely alienates everyone. I mean, what you've seen happen over and over again.
I go and I talk occasionally at journalism conferences because they give me a free hotel room.
You're such a sucker.
And what people say is, there's no money in this, blah, 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 blah. People used to make more money in print. And the alternative I hear constantly, watch this, I'm about to throw my co-host under the bus. It's going to be awesome.
Do it.
Is, these guys have a thing where they're going to pay people by selling something, which I think is great. And I think what the Atavist is doing and what a lot of people are doing in that space, there's plenty of people doing Kickstarters. I think Matter just launched science journalism. Mm-hmm. Is awesome. But what you're doing, I don't think I could find another person to explain how that works in the world right now, actually, who's doing it independent on this level. And so I think a lot of people don't really know how something like the All does work.
I mean, let's be honest, it barely works. I mean, here's the thing, like, I would like to be paying people more.
Yeah.
That's something we hope to get to. So one way we're going to do that is by books. Mm-hmm. Hopefully other products that are involved, people purchasing things.
Tell me about that. So that would be like all writers publishing books through all?
My ideal way to do this, which we're working on, is to hire a books editor and have them do a small number of books a year, but treat them very seriously. I don't think, and I think people in this room and office would agree with me, that I don't think you can make a bunch of books and dump them online.
Yes.
It doesn't work.
Well, it's an interesting thing. I've actually said, I was like, the bigger magazines and the book world are benefiting from you. Like, you are the All Is in Some Way serves as a farm league for writers.
But that's good.
I can't count how many writers have written for the All and then are writing for GQ.
But I want that. That's what I want. Like, yeah. And I mean, there's a funny situation. I mean, I've worked at The Observer, which was the old Farm League, right? That mm-hmm. The Observer used to be the place where you worked, then you got a job at the Times or whatever magazine and stuff. And then that came to a crashing halt for whatever reason, mostly systemic reasons, not reasons related to The Observer. I'm not throwing anyone under the bus on that one. But, you know, I would love to be a place where I can then retain those people that I'd love to retain. But also I want them to go off and make a lot of money or like have a good time or have good experiences. Not even the money. I want them to have the good experiences.
But I mean, if you are the Farm League, and I think you're a successful editor at picking talent and at finding the people who can write, isn't there an opportunity for you to also be the major leagues and to be part of that bigger money?
Yeah, I will say there's one model we thought of, and there's a lot. There's when you do modeling for things like this. This is so boring that we're having this conversation to so many people, and I do sound like a total asshole. But the one thing we modeled out was like, well, what if this was? And this sounds so stupid, but what if this was an agency as a model? Like, what if we said like, we will invest in your careers. We want, 8% of everything for the next X years or whatever. And we will then try and like make this happen. But that's not crazy. Well, it's not crazy. In some ways, it's actually more fair to writers instead of being like, we'll pay you a pittance and then like introduce you to nice people or whatever. But on some level, it is too hard or something. I don't know. Like, it just doesn't feel right. It's not us. We're not promotion-y. We've never promoted anything. So, look, you can try on all these models. But then committing to one of them is a lot of work. So you can set up this infrastructure, but it's not. So we are now in the process of growing up and adding on to our infrastructure, both in terms of tech, in terms of products, in terms of how we support writers, hopefully, and all that jazz.
Huh. So... it's interesting. I'm of the opinion that print magazines are not long for this world, and you're a rare, true digital magazine that's always been a digital magazine. It's never had any aspirations towards print.
It's not a bad idea to do sometimes.
Print.
Yeah.
Is this also an exclusive here?
No, we are not. Yeah. Surprise, putting together a print magazine. Can you imagine?
Glossy quarterly.
It's, it's just like GQ, $46,000 a page. can you imagine? What do they do with all that money?
A lot of lunch.
Well, now they don't have, I guess. Now they don't have all that
Less money. Lunch.
Less lunch.
They
used to take me out to, by the way, those were good times.
Yeah.
I got a lot of lunch.
Yeah. How much Condé Nast money do you think you've personally spent?
I mean, I personally got like $5,000 for zero printed words out of Jan Wenner. Like, this was like kilfy after kilfy after kilfy at Rolling Stone. It was great. I was like, fine, these stories are terrible. You're right. You should kill them, but you should not keep paying me for them.
I'm interested by your comment that if you wanted to do that, you would need to be more of a mercenary. And I think that someone who is noted as something of a mercenary is Nick Denton, who's running Gawker, which is probably like the closest evil stepbrother to the All.
Oh, well, no.
Who's you're evil? Just, who's
you're
evil?
You're trolling for page views now. Look at you.
I'm SEOing this.
No, I mean, look, Gawker Mean is enormous.
But, I was actually going to ask a question about both of you. Both you and Gawker, which is... We have writers on this program who, Gawker and Gawker Media are also starting to do a lot more features than they've ever done. And you're doing features on The All. You're doing features on Hairpins, had some great features recently. You're overlapping with traditional print magazines more than ever before. Mm-hmm. And people come in and say, there's a lot of doomsaying coming in saying, we do it better but the internet's gonna do it all. You know, it's gonna do it all first and cheaper. And an example was I'm totally like stirring hype within this podcast since the last one is Joshua Davis. But Joshua Davis had been working for 6 months on this piece on McAfee of McAfee antivirus. Mm-hmm. Flying to Belize, doing all this stuff. And before he puts out his piece on it, Gizmodo does their 2,000-word dump on it. I don't know. Let's just say the All has not done anything like that. And not that there's anything wrong with doing that, also, in my estimation. But where do you see that kind of stuff converging? What happens there?
Well, I mean, Gawker's not doing it cheap.
Right.
That's a fortune they're spending over there. So, I mean.
But less, say, on that story, probably. I mean, the story is not, you know, it's one trip. It's I think it was maybe a killed story picked up. It's still not commissioning original stories.
Well, it's not planned in a monthly meeting that then goes through a committee.
Sending a photographer and not, you know, all of that stuff.
Having done a couple of those magazine stories myself, I am horrified by the time management involved in the people who work at those magazines. It's really something. But, you know, this is the problem. It's because magazines have absent editors.
Mm-hmm.
I will not name names, you know, because I do like money. But but they're in fashion shows. You can't get a hold of X, you know, for 3 days when he's in Paris. And you're then in a committee, and then you're going to go tell a writer something, and then you do talk to your boss, and then you do go to an editorial meeting, and you come back and tell them something else. And that goes on for 6 to 8 weeks. It's ridiculous. Like, there's miscommissioning, there's overcommissioning, there's misguiding. It's a disaster. Websites should have a little more of that, maybe, but they should. It's nothing to emulate.
Do you see that as you're coming? What is the competition for? What do you wake up worrying about?
One thing I would like for us we're going to try and change the next year a little bit. I would like a little more. I would like more news reporting. That was actually one of our original goals early on, and it's hard to manage when you're a little tapped.
How do you see getting into that?
I would like to hire a couple kids and run them and have a good time
in New York or in the world at large.
Yeah.
How do you view the sort of tension between being New York based and reporting nationally and internationally?
Features desks aren't always that timely. So if we're a feature magazine or whatever the heck, I've never actually referred to us as a magazine. This is your fault.
Have you guys heard of this magazine, The All?
Pretty cool. God, it's so weird to say that. No, we're like a stupid website. I like the form of reporting, and I like working with young people, and I would like us to have a couple kids next year, maybe. It would be nice.
A couple kids in one year.
Kiddos. Well, you know.
Twins or like different ethnicities?
I'm gonna IVF myself some kids.
I was going through like stories, all stories that that I had found that were on long form, that were linked to on long form, and I was like, okay, what's the thread here? These are the stories. There's a story about a broken penis.
Oh, we actually had a penis series, basically. It was just kind of weirdly this thing happened. We had a lot of penis.
A story about a legal drug facility.
Oh, yeah.
A story about a funeral director's conference.
Ooh, that was
a story
good
one. About McRib.
Oh, the McRib was beautiful.
And it led me to wonder, where are you getting all this stuff? And what is an all story? How do you make an all story?
There's a problem. And I was actually just talking about this today. There's a problem with the internet age in which, you know, we can get pitched, which is great. Like, it's awesome to be pitched. Like, yep. That's lovely. It's like, oh my God. I'm actually always flattered every time someone pitches us, yep, which is, you know,
thousands of times a day.
No. And there's a thing when you're meeting someone the first time on email, it's sort of like okay, Cupid or whatever.
Yep.
You're like, I don't know if you're charming or horrifying or like, are you a good person? Like, I want to ask these people everything, but I can't. It's so hard to get the right answer. The questions are, you don't care about their skills. It's behavioral.
I see you as like a great scout of writers.
I am not.
Someone at slightly retired.
I have to say, like, again, I will give a vast array of credit to Carrie Fry for wrangling writers, working with writers, being delightful in general.
What do you do now? You just retired?
I don't do anything.
Looking through child catalogs.
I mean, like, you know, I mean, there's like a lot of dumb stuff to do in a business.
Yeah.
You know, there's what's on my to-do list. We have to review some legal documents. We have to, you know, and like, I mean, you know, we do editorial stuff too. I'm not, you know, but
You've
it's
been
lame. There's a lot of lame, boring things in business.
Well, no, I see. This podcast is supposed to cover those things. That's why I'm interested in talking
to you.
You're
very boring.
You're one of the few people. If I get someone in here who writes for GQ and I say, like, so what do you think about advertising on the internet? It's like, I don't know. It's not my problem. I've never even seen the story on the internet. You are making the whole sausage here.
I'm making like a quarter of five different sausages.
And they're all spicy.
More important people are making the vast majority of those sausages. I mean, if you want to run a good business, hire like really smart people.
I'm shocked also that you have the time to do reviewing yourself while you're doing all this other stuff.
It's so dumb.
Why is it dumb?
Do you know I'm finishing a book that's due in like 8 days?
That was my kicker question.
It's dumb. I'm so dumb.
Tell me about your book, Corey.
No. It's long form.
long form.
It's not that long. It's
yeah. Nice. Short book form.
It's a short book. Wait, what's the opposite of long reads? It's a short long
Kindle form.
Kindle form. Wow.
And so
it's like we've been in this room for hours.
We have been there.
This is like an episode of Alias where you're pulling out my teeth.
What? Tell me about you. Won't tell me about your book at all.
My book is a history of New York City in 2009 and about what it's like being young and in love.
And do you profiled four people?
Yeah, I just followed some people around a little bit.
Who are the people you followed?
People, just normal people, everyday people. Tell me about you.
Tell me about them.
They're cool people. They're smart people. And they were living through, like all of us were, living through a rather ridiculous time in New York City.
What was the experience? I mean, how did doing a book change your perspective on
that? You know what doing a book is? You actually, it's just going home and writing in a blog every night that no one sees.
Really?
Yeah, no, this is all it is. Yeah, it's like you're like, I'm typing in my secret blog, which is in Microsoft Word.
Did you have an urge to write, to publish any of the stuff you were writing for the book on the web?
Or? No, never.
No.
No, and actually no one's even seen any of it.
What was it like following people?
I've always liked reporting best. I really like it.
Yeah.
I love non-news reporting.
Huh.
I like following people around.
Had you done that kind of thing before?
Yeah, it was my favorite thing to do with The Observer for a while. It was really creepy.
Just following people
around.
Because I find it interesting that there's such a divide between those two things that you couldn't do something like what your project is in real time.
I would like to do the first episodic nonfiction serial. I think it'd be awesome.
It'd be fantastic.
It's so cool. And besides Jersey Shore,
I actually find the premise for your book very compelling. The only downside for me is that I would wish that it was about 2012.
Yeah. Right.
And that it's like watching a live basketball game versus a recorded one.
If I quit smoking and don't die, then I will do this in 5 years or something. But yeah.
Your book took a couple years to put together, but you could see doing this in the future.
I would love to just like write stupid stories. You know, it'd be a great job. But I don't know if that'll ever happen for me. Reporting's weird because it's so much about acts of omission, and it's very strange. Leaving things out.
I think that's a good note to end on.
Goodbye.
Thank you, Corey Sicha.
I meant it was all ironic. I didn't mean any of it.
You didn't mean any of this?
It's all insincere.
And thank you to Lauren Kirchner for editing this episode.
Good luck, pal.
Thanks to Tiny Letter for sponsoring this. My co-hosts are Max Linsky and Evan Ratliff. We'll be back next week.